Okay, here we go. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So today we're going to talk about Earth Day. We're going to talk about the Earth. And this one day that was designated is kind of hilarious, isn't it? One day. But, you know, like with many important things, it's helpful for us to designate a time or a day to do something, to remember something. So, also, in many places, including Santa Cruz, it's a day to support science and scientists. So last week there was a march in Santa Cruz, and there may be another one today. I don't know. Maybe some of you know. So we can think of science as an effort to see clearly. To see clearly what is happening in any given moment. Yeah? And scientists are people that do that. So in a way, we can think of Zen practice as scientific, in the sense that we attend to each moment, to what is before us. We let go of imposing our fixed notions on it, and we allow the evidence, to speak scientifically, of the moment to support our vision and our engagement in the world. So we all know that we can't exist without the Earth. The question is, how often do we remember that? How often does it really impact us that we are of the Earth? Our very shape is determined by the fact that the Earth holds our feet to the ground with gravity, that the air that we breathe, everything that is of this Earth has shaped who we are. So we are made for this Earth. We see beauty because the eyes that we have and the nose and the tongue, all of that is made of and with this Earth. We can't even say that we depend on the Earth, because that makes it sound like we could take off or leave it, which of course we could. We could fly to another planet. But that planet, in order for us to exist there, would have to be very much like Earth, unless we created an artificial environment that recreated Earth. So our question then is, how do we honor that which supports and creates our every move, that which we are? How do we honor that? One way is to sit down, to feel our butt on the floor or the chair, to stop the spinning thoughts, or at least just pay attention to them spinning away like a hamster on a wheel. All of the thoughts that pull us away from our concrete reality, and just be it. When we place ourselves on the earth, we are like Buddha touching the earth, you know. When Mara, delusion, challenged Buddha in the long night where he sat in his effort to wake up, the final challenge of delusion was, who do you think you are that you can wake up? And Buddha's response was not to bring out all of his credentials, but to simply touch the earth. And the earth rumbled. The earth responded. The earth witnessed. So when we sit in Zazen, we are sitting on this sacred place, this earth. We are touching the earth. We are recognizing completely with our full hearts and minds that we are of this place. Another dimension of this is to act with awareness in our everyday lives. We ask, how are we grateful for what we eat, wear, breathe, and how do we express that gratitude? How do we build and support within ourselves and express in our actions an attitude of simple reverence, an orientation in the world and everything of it that expresses our respect, our care. This is a central value for many wise teachings, and it is certainly a part of Dogen Zenji, our founder's teachings. Dogen tells us that all beings, sentient and insentient, living and non-living, human, animal, plant, rocks, teacups, are Buddha nature. He says that he regrets that most people do not realize that the universe is proclaiming the actual body of the Buddha, since they only perceive what they concoct with their own minds. We do this all the time. We do not perceive Buddha, as Dogen Zenji says, Buddha's shape, form, and voice in the landscape. We cannot see or appreciate this truth when we fall in the habit of defining reality only in terms of our own needs, when we regard everything only in its usefulness to us. How does it relate to us? What will it do for us? How can we use it? This does not recognize the value and beauty of each and every dimension of our universe. It's something we do all the time, right? Delusion. Human beings, we live in a world of delusion, and our effort is to wake up from that delusion. So we must take care to unseat this self-centered self, this self that doesn't recognize who we are. Particularly if we want to be good citizens of the world we live in, active participants in a healthy and vibrant world. Our practice requires that we listen to others and to ourselves, what all others have to say to us, without immediately slotting that person or that aspect of reality into our preconceived notions. Dogen says, the way insentient beings expound the true teachings should not be understood to be like the way sentient beings do. So he's very careful to say the rocks preach the Dharma. Right? Even rocks preach the Dharma. And he says that we should not usurp the voices of the living or not living, and conjecture about how non-living beings in terms of our own vision. In other words, we should listen carefully. We should examine our thoughtlessness and release our hearts and minds from the prison of self-centeredness, not to colonize reality with our ideas. Again, listen. When we do that, we have the opportunity to be taught. So when rocks preach the Dharma, Dogen Zenji tells us, they do it in rock voices. We may not be able to understand these rock voices, but that doesn't mean they're not there. We don't understand other human languages. Some people can speak 7 languages, 10 languages. How many languages are there on Earth? A whole lot of languages. But usually, if we spend enough time and listen carefully, we can begin to understand another language. The same is true for our world. So what we do when we let go of self-centeredness and allow ourselves to be of this world, when we walk out and allow what we call nature to touch us, we are able to do this. So, you know, what is nature? after all, as if it's something separate from us, right? Yeah. Dogen tells us that the sutras, the words in the expression of the Buddha, are the entire universe, he says. Mountains and rivers and the great earth, plants and trees, they are self and others, taking meals, wearing clothes, confusion and dignity. All of that are the sutras. So there's nothing that's not included in our practice. Our practice is to live a life with this truth at the center. All being, the entire universe, is preaching the Dharma, is Buddha. So the entire world is our teacher then. The entire world speaks to us about what's most true, how to live, who we are, who all beings are. So we make the effort to see as clearly as we can, just to appreciate, just to learn. Dogen states, when you endeavor in right practice, the voices and figures of streams and the sounds and shapes of mountains, together with you, bounteously deliver 84,000 gathas. Gathas are teachings. Just as you are unsparingly in surrendering fame and wealth and body-mind, so are the brooks and the mountains. Shall I read that again? When you endeavor in right practice, the voices and figures of streams and the sounds and shapes of mountains, together with you, bounteously deliver 84,000 gathas. Just as you are unsparing and surrendering fame and wealth and body-mind, so are the brooks and the mountains. So, what he's saying here is that we, by our very life, are giving to this world. We're a participant. We're giving to this world. If we are living our life in the effort to wake up, we are generous with our life. And in the same way that we are, simply by being the mountains, the rivers, the trees, the rocks, everything is giving itself to the world. So this is the spirit of our way, and it should guide us in our relationship in and with the world. This is not just a private experience. When we see in this way and find our way to act and support this Buddha world, we face the world as it is, directly, and find a way to live. This is not about creating a fantasy world, you know, some place where nature is this beautiful, uncomplicated, lovely garden. So it's not easy to face the world we live in, right? This world. When we pay attention, we might even feel despair. Yeah? We hear about the rhino. We hear about the plastic in the ocean. We see things that we love fading. We worry. We fret. Or maybe we just turn away and go to sleep. But that doesn't do any good. This is the world we live in, not another. It doesn't do any good at all to succumb to despair. It simply paralyzes us. I've been thinking about this. I mean, it's something I think we all consider, right? How do we engage? How do we stay alive to this world? How do we honor the earth and face what we live in? And I read a piece by a writer and activist named Rebecca Solnit. People know her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a kind of distillation of a book she printed, she published, I don't know, a year or two ago, maybe more, called Hope in the Dark, Untold Histories and Wild Possibilities. I highly recommend it. I was struck by her clarity in describing how we can narrow our vision in a way that is both inaccurate and toxic and dispiriting, in a way that erodes our ability to act on behalf of our world, and how expanding our vision to include all aspects of our history, our experience, our reality is both more accurate and more sustaining. So, I sometimes wonder if as humans we are constructed to focus on what is wrong. Have you ever thought that? You know, you look at something and you pick out the flaws. You look at a beautiful room and you notice that the picture that's off whack, or, oh, you get critical of other people's human foibles, or you, whatever. Does anybody else ever do that? So, why do we do that? You know, and I thought, well, maybe one reason it's a good survival strategy. If we see danger, something negative, and we act accordingly, they could save us, right? So it's short term. It's not a bad thing. Sometimes I also think that we are created to live in small groups, maybe 15, 25 people. And everybody kind of has a job in the group. Have you ever noticed how some people are more negative than others? And others are like, oh, wow, it's all lovely, you know? We need that. We all need that. If you get a group of people together, then everybody has a focus, right? People who are really negative are like, oh, man, this is really bad. We're in trouble. You go, oh, okay, we've got to pay attention to that. And the other is like, oh, it's so beautiful. Or I'm hungry. Or whatever. You know, if you bring it all together, it balances. That's what we have to do with our own minds. So short-term anxiety and all this, we learned something about this in the last few years, is not a bad thing. But it's not complete. It can lead to an increase in corrosive fear, defensive posture, passivity, rage shrinks our world. It distorts our responses. Solnit's writing about hope. And she points out, I think this is a really good point, that hope has gotten a bad name because it is confused with wishful thinking. So in our desire to create a permanent world in an impermanent world, we think we're going to get it right. We're going to fix it. So hope is this, it flies in the face of reality, right? If I just do enough, I'm going to fix it. It's going to be perfect. It's going to be right. We'll all be okay. But that's wishful thinking. That's not being alive in the world that we have. She says hope is not that. It is a grounded, open not knowing. It is an attitude that does not impose fixed ideas on reality. So I want to read you a quote. I want you to think about it in terms of Buddhist practice. I'll read it to you twice, okay? Solnit says, hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. When you recognize uncertainty, you recognize that you may be able to influence outcomes. You alone, or you in concert with a few dozen or several million others. Hope is the embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will be fine without our involvement. Pessimists adopt the opposite position. Both excuse themselves from acting. Hope is the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when it may matter and who and what it may impact are not things we can know beforehand. We may not, in fact, know them afterwards either, but they matter all the same. And history is full of people whose influence is most powerful after they are gone. You want to listen to that again? Okay. Hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. When you recognize uncertainty, you recognize that you may be able to influence outcomes. You alone, or you in concert with a few dozen or several million others. Hope is the embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will be fine without our involvement. Pessimists adopt the opposite position. Both excuse themselves from acting. Hope is the belief that what we do, and I would add who we are, matters, even though how and when it may matter and who or what it may impact are not things we can know beforehand. We may not, in fact, know them afterwards either, but they matter all the same, and history is full of people whose influence was most powerful after they were gone. So to bring this into Soto Zen terms, we say this is the spirit of Fu'e. Fu'e, not knowing. Dogen says, we live in not knowing. This is not cluelessness. Not knowing is an active stance. I'm not going to impose knowing. I'm not going to decide ahead of time what things are. I'm going to be alive and alert to what's actually going on. It's also the life of the bodhisattva, right? The person dedicated to awakening. We live this life in the spirit of not knowing. And Dogen tells us over and over again, you may not, you know, this awakening may not be within your knowing or not knowing. Knowing or not knowing is not the point. It's a life that's the point. So we live this life in a spirit of not knowing, of finding the beauty in a life of response, activity. It's response, it's aliveness, it's how that matters. So the way of the bodhisattva asks us to engage without the tyranny of thinking we must do it all, or we must be able to see the end game. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them, right? The bodhisattva vow. To fully engage in that vow, we must renounce our need to be the one that knows and find a joyful mind. Dogen calls it joyful mind. It's one of the four aspects that we must cultivate along with many others. But joyful mind, we simply devote our lives and our energy to the way with a clear eye and a caring heart, right? We find the joy in response, not in the need for a specific outcome, because we can only see so far. We're just human beings, after all. So we ground ourselves in this earth, this moment. We expand our view. We take the risk of hope in the hope that she's talking about, and find our way. This is, if we are going to honor the earth, this is what we do. If we're going to honor our human lives and all the beings that live and jump and fly and sit in rock piles. This is the spirit of it. So the great teacher John Muir said, I would say John Muir Roshi, old teacher, he says, I wish I were so drunk and sequoial, that's an adjective, that I could preach the green brown woods to all the juiceless world. Descending from this divine wilderness like a John the Baptist eating Douglas squirrels and world honey or wild anything and crying, repent, the kingdom of sequoias is at hand. Okay, I'm going to read that again. I wish I were so drunk and sequoial that I could preach the green brown woods to all the juiceless world. Descending from this divine wilderness like a John the Baptist eating Douglas squirrels and world honey or wild anything and crying, repent, the kingdom of sequoias is at hand. Isn't that beautiful? That's joyful mind. That is joyful mind. John Muir was quite clear about what he saw. He wasn't, you know, a romantic ninny. He could see what was going on. We can hear the vigor in his voice. We can see him racing down the mountains, right, with the latest sutra that he had heard in his wanderings, all on behalf of all beings. So he saw clearly. He heard clearly, as much as he could. And this came from stillness as well as activity. We often dismiss. We don't need to go to the Sierras to hear this, although it's sometimes helpful. Go to the beach, go to someplace beautiful. If we pay attention, our mundane world teaches us the spirit all the time. If we miss it, or if we dismiss it, we can be caught in despair. We can see only what's fading. We find it too painful to contemplate the world that we're in. But that's not the way of the Bodhisattva. As I say over and over again, Bodhisattvas are not grim. Bodhisattvas have a joyful mind. And to cultivate that kind of engagement, we widen our vision. We include it all. We live a life of participation in this great green earth, blue earth, as astronauts say, without needing to know the outcome. Because we can't know the outcome. But we can respond. So we pay attention. We let go of perspectives that shrink our world. And we respond with vigor. We kind of link arms with John Muir, right? And all the other beings that are caring for this world. So this is the practice of gratitude and engagement. And I'm gonna end by reading something to you. If this is a great sutra. This is like such a beautiful and profound sutra. It is called the Smokey the Bear Sutra, written by Gary Snyder. Once in the Jurassic, about 150 million years ago, the great Sun Buddha in this corner of the infinite void gave a discourse to all the assembled elements and energies, to the standing beings, the walking beings, the flying beings, and the sitting beings, even the grasses, to the number of 13 billion, each one born from a seed assembled there, a discourse concerning enlightenment on the planet Earth. He said, or she said, or they said. In some future time, there will be a continent called America. It will have great centers of power called such as Pyramid Lake, Walden Pond, Mount Rainier, Big Sur, Everglades, and so forth, and powerful nerves and channels such as Columbia River, Mississippi River, and Grand Canyon. The human race in that era will get into troubles all over its head and practically wreck everything in spite of its strong, intelligent Buddha nature. The twisted strata of the great mountains and the pulsings of volcanoes are my love burning deep in the earth. My obstinate compassion is schist and basalt and granite to be mountains to bring down the rain. In the future American era, I shall enter a new form to cure the world of loveless knowledge that brings with blind hunger and mindless rage, eating food that will not fill it. And he showed himself in his true form of Smokey the Bear. A handsome, smoky-colored brown bear standing on his hind legs, showing that he is aroused and watchful, bearing in his right paw the shovel that digs to the truth beneath appearances and cuts the roots of useless attachments and flings damp sand on the fires of greed and war. His left paw in the mudra of comradely display, indicating that all creatures have the full right to live to their limits, and that of deer, rabbits, chipmunks, snakes, dandelions, and lizards will grow in the realm of the Dharma. Wearing the blue work overall symbolic of slaves and laborers and countless people, I'm changing this, oppressed by a civilization that claims to save but often destroys. Wearing the broad-brimmed hat of the West, symbolic of the forces that guard the wilderness, which is the natural state of the Dharma and the true path of people on earth. All true paths lead through mountains. With a halo of smoke and flame behind the forest fires of the Kali Yuga, fires caused by the stupidity of those who think things can be gained and lost, whereas the truth, all is contained, vast and free, in the blue sky and the green earth of one mind. Round-bellied to show his kind nature and that the great earth has food enough for everyone who loves her and trusts her. Trampling underfoot wasteful freeways and needless suburbs, smashing the worms of totalitarianism, indicating the task. His followers become free of cars, houses, canned foods, universities, and shoes, master the three mysteries of their own body, speech, and mind, and fearlessly chop down the rotten trees and prune out the sick limbs of this country, America, and burn the leftover trash. Wrathful but calm, austere but comic, Smokey the Bear will illuminate those who would help him, and for those who would hinder or slander him, he will put them out. This is his great mudra. Nama Samanta Vajranam Chandra Maharshana Shapata Ham Traka Ham Mam. I dedicate myself to the universal diamond to be this raging fury be destroyed. May this raging fury be destroyed. And he will protect those who love woods and waters. Gods and animals, hobos and mad people, prisoners and sick people, musicians, playful people, and hopeful children. And if anyone is threatened by advertising, air pollution, television, or the police, he will chant Smokey the Bear's war spell. Drown their butts, crush their butts, drown their butts, crush their butts. And Smokey the Bear will surely appear to put the enemy out with his Vajra shovel. Now, those who recite this sutra and then try to put it in practice will accumulate merit as countless as the sands of Arizona and Nevada, and will help save the planet Earth from total oil slick. We'll enter the age of harmony of people and nature. We'll win the tender love and caresses of men, women, and beasts. We'll always have ripened blackberries to eat and a sunny spot under a pine tree to sit at. And in the end, we'll win highest perfect enlightenment. Thus we have heard.